But first this evening we're going to look at the Stardust tragedy, because in the early hours of Valentine's Day 1981, a fire ripped through the Stardust ballroom in the suburb of Artane in North Dublin. The 800 people inside scrambled for the exits, more than 200 were injured and 48 people lost their lives, with half of the dead aged 18 or under. The families affected instantly sought answers as to what had caused the deadly blaze, but the road ahead would be a long one, with families often feeling dismissed or ignored. But their campaign to get to the truth never faltered, and eventually an inquest was established almost a year ago, which heard 90 days of evidence from some 373 witnesses. At around 2 o'clock this afternoon, verdicts were delivered on what was the biggest fire tragedy in the history of the state. Order Ryan, you maintained a live blog on this throughout the course of the day. There was plenty in it. Just remind us briefly why these inquests had taken place and how we arrived at this point after what the families regarded as many false starts.
Yeah, as you said, their families have been campaigning for over four decades for justice, and the inquests held over the last year are not the first time the fire has been investigated. Back in 1981, a tribunal of inquiry under Mr. Joseph Ronan Keane concluded that the blaze was probably caused by arson rather than being an accident or another cause. This verdict was always contested by the families and survivors and was officially struck from the public record in 2009. In 2017, the government appointed retired judge Mr. Justice Pat McCartan to examine potential new evidence and circumstances surrounding the tragedy. That November, he ruled that no new independent inquiry was warranted, and again, the families disputed this. And in 2019, Phoenix Law made an application on behalf of many of the families calling for fresh inquests, and then the then Attorney General, Seamus Wolfe, ultimately agreed, and he said that the original inquest didn't sufficiently look into how the deaths occurred and how the fire started. So that's how we eventually got to April last year when these inquests were started.
And the family pushed all the time for this. They even engaged their own experts to produce a report which had an alternative explanation to what had been put into the public domain before.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't be here today really without the families and their, you know, their dogged pursuit of justice in this. They've been trying for many years. Sadly, many of some of the survivors and relatives, they've passed away over the years, but there has been a core group of campaigners and family members who've really pushed for this over the years and led to finally new inquests being set up last year.
By stark contrast to the owner of the venue, who got redress for the property damage back in the early 80s, pretty promptly, yeah. A sum of over £500,000, which was a substantial sum in the money of the day.
Yeah, it was huge money back then, and we couldn't report on it until today. But Eamon Butterley, in the closing days of the inquest, he made a last-ditch attempt to prevent the jury from being able to consider the verdict of unlawful killing. He said it would be highly prejudicial and could damage his reputation, but ultimately that effort did fail, and obviously we've gotten to the point today where the jury did find that conclusion.
So the inquest began almost 12 months ago, April 2023, and they began, I know, with pen portraits of those that had lost their lives. So the people who had been killed very much put in the centre of the proceedings, and there was often very emotional and moving testimony from a number of witnesses. Who appeared before the inquest and gave testimony over that time?
Yeah, so the pen portraits, I suppose, were relatively unique from an Irish point of view anyway, but the coroner, Dr. Myra Cullinan, had said she wanted to hear about the people who had died in the fire, and on 18th of May last, when that section of the inquest concluded, she said, you know, there was extreme sadness in the room, but there was also occasional humour and warmth, and that it was lovely to hear about the people whose lives were so tragically cut short. As you said, they were all in their teens or 20s. The final pen portrait was delivered in the sitting last May was for Margaret Thornton, who was just 19 when she died in the fire. Patricia Green, one of her sisters, said Margaret loved music and concerts, and like any young woman, she had lots of dreams about the future. After the fire, Patricia said she spent years just waiting for Margaret to come through the door. To say I miss her would be an understatement. I think a part of all of us died that day, as well as, you know, the very moving testimony we had from survivors and relatives. As you say, there was over 90 days of direct evidence. There was 373 witnesses. So as well as the family members, they included evidence from survivors, staff who worked at the nightclub, firefighters, emergency service personnel, pathologists, fire experts, and Eamon Butterley as well, as you mentioned.
Who hadn't been heard before. A lot of the evidence there concentrated on the head dorm man at the time in the case of Mr. Butterley. A lot of the responsibility in his testimony was laid on that head doorman, who was, I think, is a relative by marriage.
Yeah, and the most contentious issues put to him did surround the locking of exit doors, where while patrons obviously were trying to open the doors on the site on the night of the fire and they were unable to get out. And Butterley gave evidence that the practice of locking certain doors at the nightclub for a portion of the evening was only introduced a few weeks before the fire, and he claimed this had been forced on him because people were trying to get into the nightclub for free, and there was also controversial practice of mock locking the doors, so a chain might be put around the door and it wasn't actually locked, but it had the appearance of being locked and it would impede someone who was trying to push it and open it. So the locked door, that was a major factor in the evidence as well.
One of the verdicts today concerned specifically the locking or obstruction of the door.
Yeah, the jury, obviously they returned that unlawful killing for all 48 victims, and they gave their reasoning. They said they found that the fire started in the hot press of the main bar of the venue, and it was caused by an electrical fault. And they found that the use of carpet tiles on the walls and the presence of polyurethane in the foam and the seating, which is flammable, that was also an issue that contributed to how quickly the fire spread. And there were those other factors of the doors being locked or appearing locked or being obstructed sometimes by bins or other things and people couldn't open them. All of that, as well as a lack of preparedness by the staff of how to deal with the fire if that were to occur. There was a failure as well of the emergency light system, and then obviously there was a lack of visibility as well, that smoke spread so quickly. So there were a large number of factors that they resulted in delivering their verdict today.
And the verdicts that were open to the jury today, can you run us through what the options were for them? Obviously there had been two attempts in the High Court to restrict the jury from being able to offer a verdict of unlawful killing. But what would the other of options have been?
Yeah, so Dr. Myra Cullinan told the jurors they had five verdicts that they could return. So the first was accidental death. The second was death by misadventure. The third was an open verdict. The fourth was a narrative verdict. And the fifth was unlawful killing, which obviously they went for. So Dr. Cullinan had told the jury that the standard of proof to be applied for the verdicts of accidental death, death by misadventure and a narrative verdict were on the balance of probabilities, so whether or not something was more likely than not to have happened. And she said some commentators might put a percentage of it, of it could be 51% versus 49%, so you know it could be minor things that made the difference there. But in relation to unlawful killing, she said the standard of proof to be applied for a finding of this verdict was different to the others. She said the legal test the jury must apply was that beyond a reasonable doubt before they could record that verdict, which ultimately they came to today.
All right. And who they had reached their decision, I think, yesterday. But today, in order to give the families time to gather, to travel, to be at the venue. Mm-hmm. So who gathered there today to hear these verdicts being delivered?
Yeah, so obviously there were lots of family members and relatives and survivors. There was lots of journalists in the room. The pillar room was packed out quite quickly and other people had to remain outside. There was a Zoom call as well. People could watch remotely, and very quickly that reached capacity of 500 people, so more people couldn't join. But the room itself was packed, and I wasn't in the room, but my colleague Christine Bohan was, and she said it was incredibly emotional. You could hear a pin drop when, you know, they said they had reached a unanimous verdict. The same verdict for all 48 people. There was a gasp, there was an intake of breath, there was lots of tears. We had Bridget McDermott was one of the women who was there. She's now 87 and she lost three children, George, William and Marcella, in the fire, and a horrendous loss. One of my colleagues was speaking to her grandson Connor today, and they asked what it felt for the family, and he said, "You can't really put it into words to see my family fighting, the others' families fighting for so long. It's inspiring but also sad. She just wanted the truth about what happened to her kids." And Annette Keegan, a long-term campaigner as well, who survived the fire. Her two sisters, Mary and Martina, died in the blaze, and she said it was an overwhelming day. And Antoinette herself said, "This day is for the 48 people who never came home."
I'm going to go to the panel now. Michael Fitzmaurice, Dara Mackin, the solicitor for the family, one of the solicitors for the family, he said amid the shouting and the reaction to this, the words "at last" were audible from some people. I don't think he could pick out who from, but I'm sure the families felt that most keenly. But a lot of people watching their struggle to this point over the years probably felt a degree of that too.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think we need to put this into context. When I heard the verdict today, I just thought back. I remember this really tragic night. I remember we had a black and white television. It's that long ago. I remember, and we hadn't it long. And to look at the pictures those times, it looked horrific. And we were only youngsters. And I salute the determination of the families that kept constantly, you know, fighting for justice for their loved ones that they have lost. And no verdict today or any time will ever bring back their loved ones. But they, in honour of the people they lost, kept that fight going. And I do think that the state needs to look at an apology. I do think that. It is sad in one way that we have spent 43 years and, you know, we look at so many tragedies that has happened down through the years and not enough of investigation into it. And, you know, at times maybe the state not doing the job that it should have done in looking into things. And it's sad that it has taken this long. And unfortunately, some people have passed since that will never see the justice done for those people and there'd be family members. But I think one can only salute the determination and basically the unwavering determination of all those families down through the years to keep it in, to make sure they kept it in the spotlight, to make sure they fought for the rights. And today they have got a verdict. They have got a verdict that they are happy with, but it will never, ever, ever undo the loss of the loved ones that has gone.
All right. Well, the issue of a state apology was raised with the Minister for Justice earlier. She was speaking to our colleagues on Drive Time. This is what Helen McEntee had to say in reaction to what we heard today and the verdicts and also on the issue of the apology.
I regret that it's taken this long, and I think the fact that there have been so many different processes that have come out with different outcomes that have never really done what needed to be done, it is regretful, yes. And
shameful?
In a way, yes. And I can't speak on behalf of government, but I can only say on my own behalf and as Minister for Justice, I'm so sorry that this happened and that it took this long to finally get to this point. But it's important that we are at this point now.
Chris McManus, a state apology has been called from the families. Do you think it's appropriate that the state should consider the wording at the very least as to what it should be apologising for and reflect on that before it makes that statement?
Well, in the first instance, you know, I think I want to echo the comments of Deputy Fitzmaurice that our thoughts are with the survivors and the families of those who lost their lives in this awful tragedy. And again, to commend the campaigners in their pursuit for justice. You know, they've waited over four decades for answers and it's been a long time coming, but at last today it has arrived. And it's really, the verdict has just confirms what the survivors, the families, indeed the wider Dublin community have always known. In regards to the issue of an apology, you know, the families and survivors have been clear that they want the Taoiseach to apologise, and I very much believe that they should be listened to and they deserve that apology. You know, they need that. You know, they've gone through many decades of hurt. They've gone through having to overcome countless obstacles, many diversions, often put up by different statutory agencies. So I think very much so that they're entitled to hear that apology in the way that they see fit.
And do you think that apology will be more meaningful following this verdict? Because we have now a verdict from this inquest of unlawful killing. The case has been laid out. It's quite clear to the families what the state should be apologising for. Do you think it will be as clear to the representatives of the state, the government?
Well, I think, as I said, if the families are seeking that apology, and I don't think the government should, you know, in any way not concur and agree with their request. And I think the government should be fulsome in it. It was a tragedy that, and like Deputy Fitzmaurice, I was a young lad at the time, and I can remember that I was 7 or 8, but you still had that sense of the country being engulfed in this tragedy. And the fact that we're 43 years on, I think it's the very minimum that the state can do is to give the families and survivors the apology that they've requested.
All right. Barry Andrews, What should the state be apologising for here? Because obviously expressing condolences with the families at one thing is one thing, paying tribute to their courage is another. But in terms of the state acknowledging its failings, what are those specific failings that it should be acknowledging?
Well, first of all, I really want to express my admiration for the families for their tenacity and my condolences for their loss and for the terrible delay in justice being delivered. And that really is the answer to your question. For justice to take 43 years is what needs to be apologised for. I'm glad that Taoiseach has had the phone call already. I'm glad that the minister has committed to meeting with the families. They will have to digest the report when it's available. But I think they will be guided by what the families need to hear. And so it's for me, it's the very minimum that's required here, of course. I think, you know, there have been so many opportunities to fix what should have been done such a long time ago. And for it, I mean, like Chris, you know, I remember I was a young teenager and 43 years later, we're sitting here in this studio talking about this verdict. But it's just shocking.
In the end, it was in a way pretty simple, wasn't it? The Attorney General, Seamus Wolfe, agreed to something that the reports up to that point really didn't press the case for. The reports to that date didn't call for the immediate holding of an inquest. The Attorney General went ahead and advised or agreed to the holding of inquests. I suppose looking from this point, the question is, why didn't that happen earlier to get to the bottom of this?
Well, I think as the minister referred to there in her comments, there were various processes. There was obviously the vacating of the finding of probable arson, which itself took maybe 3 decades. And then the attempt by Pat McCartan to see if an inquest, and that was ran into the sand. So in fairness to Attorney General, he said, hey, look, we'll go again. And finally, justice has been delivered. So it's I'm not justifying any not 1 year of the 43 years. It's really unacceptable, and that's what has to be apologised for.
Sure, it's the state's specific role in the delay is really what the state should be apologising for.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Orla Ryan, did the families give specifics? They said they want a full apology and they wanted to come from the Taoiseach.
They do. They said they want a state apology, that it's been long overdue. Simon Harris has said, obviously, the government is now going to consider the findings, and so are An Garda Síochána. So they haven't committed one way or another, but the family wants a full state apology.
All right. Do you find it encouraging, Michael Fitzmaurice, that the Taoiseach, the Minister for Justice, have said that obviously it's a matter for the Gardaí to consider it, but that they are advising the Garda Commissioner to give it his fullest consideration, these verdicts?
Well, first of all, I welcome that Artisha, you know, rang amid the calls today. And as, you know, everyone else on your panel has agreed, that the length of time it has taken to get this, basically a proper look and a proper inquest into it, that's what the state needs to apologise for. And I think that, you know, okay, they'll have to look at all the parts of it. I understand all that. But this shouldn't be let, you know, the time is now. And I think that the families as well need to, you know, I know they'll never get closure, but closure on this part of it, that they are justified, that their fight and that their determination has finally. But the one part I look at, and I see it, I actually spoke to your researcher today, you know, sometimes there could be governments that want to do something. And I see an incident today of Stephen Donnelly. In fairness, he did make the call, you know, where a hospital was taken over, a premises belonged to someone else that would move. But like, you had a senior department official advising them, oh, don't get involved in that. And, you know, that probably happened down through the years, and I think that ministers need to take things in a stronger grip.
All right. Chris McManus, I suppose, One of the issues that's called into question here is people of limited means not having access to the levers of justice. In terms of the state considering what its response to this should be, is access to justice for people of limited means be one of those things?
Well, I believe fundamentally in the principle of access, that the legal system should be blind to who they're dealing with, that there should be no hindrance to those, regardless of their background, to be able to access justice. You know, the bottom line is this, is these families have waited 43 plus years to be able to achieve and come to this point. The important thing is for us to allow the families and survivors to have this day for them to themselves be able to process what the outcome of the inquest that we've heard today, and for them then to indicate the next steps that they want to take in that regards. But there should be no blockages to people, regardless of what background or what walk of life they come from being able to access true justice.
Barry Andrews, do you think that had something to do with it in the early 80s? I don't want to comment on the personalities involved, because obviously, yeah, you know, this is still something that's under consideration. But when you contrast how the justice system could be accessed in terms of the payment of compensation at the time, and you contrast that with how long it took the families to get this kind of redress, is there something wrong with the system of access to justice in this country when you see a contrast like that?
It's hard to make a general conclusion, but it seems in this particular case, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that it may have been an aggravating factor in the delay. I'm drawn to the, you know, the Bloody Sunday inquiry, which took decades before anybody was believed, and, you know,
Hillsborough similarly.
And you know, working class people who are impacted by a tragedy of this scale, you know, and there are common patterns, it feels like to me, and it may well have been an aggravating factor. It's hard to make a general comment about the overall access to justice in Ireland. I think it's much better now than it was, probably was in the 1980s. I think it's something that we really have to have a reflection on. And maybe when the Taoiseach is engaging with these families as part of the conversation that he and the Minister for Justice should have with them. But I think we need as well to give the Gardaí space now to make their judgments on what happens next.
In the end, Orla, what made the difference was the solidarity, the strength in numbers, the families coming together, and the sheer will of particular individuals within that group to drive forward a very effective campaign.
Yeah, you can imagine after all the setbacks over the years, if someone just said, right, enough is enough, we're not getting anywhere with this, we've tried our best, we can't do anymore. But there was that core group of campaigners and families who said, no, we are not stopping until we get new inquests and we get a verdict like this. So obviously there was immense relief among many families today, but also frustration and anger that it's taken so long to get here. But we absolutely wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for that core group of families who kept fighting over four decades.
Okay. Our congratulations and condolences to them this evening as they consider the implications of that verdict there. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.